Welcome to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. We'll start with the death notices and move on to business and sports, then the opinions and editorials, and finish up with today's horoscopes, Dear Abby, and the comics. There are no death notices in today's Arizona Republic. We'll turn now to the business section. Shareholders accuse Microsoft of fraud. Stock suffered biggest drop in years in January. Microsoft has been sued by shareholders who accused the company of defrauding them and inflating its stock price by failing to disclose showing growth in its Azure cloud business and the need to spend billions of dollars on AI infrastructure. The proposed class action led by a Michigan pension fund was filed in Seattle federal court on June 12th after Microsoft shares fell 10% on January 29th in response to its quarterly earnings report a day earlier. About $357 billion of market value was erased, and Microsoft's stock suffered its biggest one-day decline in nearly 6 years. Microsoft did not immediately respond on June 15th to requests for comment. For its second quarter ending in December, Microsoft reported 39% revenue growth in its Azure and other cloud businesses, meeting analyst forecasts but down from 40% in the prior quarter, and projected 37% to 38% growth in the first 3 months of 2026. Microsoft also reported $37.5 billion of capital spending in its second quarter, up nearly 66% from a year earlier and above the $34.3 billion that analysts projected. The lawsuit said Microsoft attributed the slowing Azure growth and higher spending to capacity constraints as it diverted resources to AI-related research and development and to its Copilot chatbot, whose rivals include Google's Gemini and OpenAI's ChatGPT. Microsoft, based in Redmond, Washington, is a major investor in OpenAI. The lawsuit is led by the City of St. Clair Shores Police and Fire Retirement System in Michigan. Defendants include several Microsoft officials, including Chief Executive Satya Nadella and Chief Financial Officer Amy Hood. The proposed class period runs from May 1, 2025 to January 28, 2026. It is common for shareholders to sue companies for alleged securities fraud after unexpected declines in stock prices. And the next headline on the business section, oil production may not return to normal soon. Damaged sites will take especially long to repair. A framework agreement between the United States and Iran on terms to end their war and reopen the Strait of Hormuz sent oil prices tumbling as traders anticipated the return of flows. But industry officials say a full return to pre-war production and refining levels is likely to take weeks, months, or even years. The following explores the main energy implications of the tentative deal. What does the deal change immediately? President Donald Trump said the Strait of Hormuz, a major shipping route for global oil and gas supplies that Iran has effectively shut down for months, would open on June 19th, and that he had ordered the end of a U.S. blockade of Iranian ports. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Kazem Garibaldi said a more expansive agreement on the wider conflict would be negotiated during a 60-day ceasefire period, including sanctions relief for Iran. How fast can oil production resume? Middle East producers, including Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, shut down millions of barrels per day of crude oil output due to the effective closure of the strait. The International Energy Agency's most recent report says that more than 14 million barrels per day of oil output is shut down, or about 14% of world demand. Some production, such as in Iraq, can resume in less than a week of a decision to restart, an official familiar with the matter said. Other fields will take much longer. Assuming operators choose a measured and controlled ramp-up, Our analysis suggests the fields affected by the Straits closure could get back to 70% of prior production within 3 months and to 90% within 6 months. The last 1 million barrels per day or so will take considerably longer, analysts at Wood Mackenzie said. Why are oil refineries in a bottleneck? The Iran war had shut down as much as 3.52 million barrels per day of refining capacity as of May 7th, according to industry monitor IIR, about 3.5% of the global total, with some plants damaged. Returning plants that were simply shut down as a precaution will take a couple of weeks, analysts say, but repairing damaged sites will take longer. Gulf refineries could reach about 90% to 95% of capacity within 40 to 60 days, Vitol Bahrain's head of research, Badr Noureddin, said earlier this month. The Middle East's total repair spending is likely to average around $46 billion, with refining and petrochemical assets accounting for the largest share due to their complexity and extent of damage, according to Rystad Energy. What about gas, including LNG? Early in the conflict, major liquefied natural gas facilities, such as those in Qatar, halted output or curtailed operations following attacks. Once a restart decision is taken, it will take around 2 weeks to turn gas into a super-chilled fuel and reach full capacity. In the liquefaction process, which turns gas into a liquid state by cooling it down to approximately minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit, the cool down is the most critical step. It is intentionally slow to avoid thermal shock. The LNG production trains, or processing lines, that turn the gas into liquid form cannot all restart simultaneously. They must be sequenced. Qatar Energy has kept three trains operating during the war to meet demand from Kuwait and Bahrain. Returning to full capacity will take years. Qatar's energy CEO said Iranian attacks had wiped out 17% of Qatar's LNG capacity for up to 5 years. Oil inventory rebuild will be slow. As a result of the supply disruption, the world's oil stocks are dwindling and a return to normal levels will be prolonged, probably taking years. Stockpiles in the world's largest economies are headed toward their lowest levels since at least 2003, squeezed at a record pace due to the lost Gulf output, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. It will take several months to fully normalize flows, and we estimate that global oil inventories have shrunk by more than 1 billion barrels since the start of the conflict, said Paul Gooden, head of natural resources at investment manager 91. 1 billion barrels would be worth over $83 billion at today's prices. Oil markets will therefore likely suffer a hangover for several years as governments seek to rebuild inventories and to insulate themselves from further geopolitical shocks. And the last item on the business section, housing market in midst of U-turn. Sellers increasingly losing the upper hand. What goes around comes around, they say. When it comes to the housing market, however, the normal cyclical rotation has taken its sweet time arriving. But now a new analysis is calling it. The long American seller's market has ended. The bidding war era is over, proclaims the report published June 11th by Realtor.com. For too long, the authors write, sellers had a free pass on pricing their homes, but no longer. Today, an overpriced home doesn't just sit. It gets stale, loses leverage, and sells for less than it would have if it had been priced right from the start, Joel Berner, a senior economist with the company, said in the report, which compared home sales data to Realtor.com listing histories. Price it right and buyers come to you, Berner said. Price it wrong and you're chasing them. 4 weeks in, the market has already delivered its verdict. You've either got competing offers or you're about to cut your price. In fact, home sales that close at the 4 week mark fetch 1.8% more relative to asking price than most homes did during the same period. After 18 weeks, those still on the market wind up selling for 1.3% less. Even though housing is still unaffordable for far too many Americans, things are shifting, Berner wrote. Buyers have more leverage than they've had in years, and that shows up clearly in the data. After the bidding war insanity of the pandemic period, the current moment is a real paradigm shift, said Steve Rees, a real estate agent and owner of Sold on Shawnee in metropolitan Oklahoma City. Homes that are presented well and priced right will sell, Rees told USA Today, and there are still agents out there who do a very average job, even though there are more options for buyers, and they are taking their time making the right decision, he says. Notably, buyers in the $750,000 to $2 million range might have the most leverage, the realtor analysis finds. After seeing a greater number of bidding wars than average during 2022, the height of the pandemic rush, the final sales numbers for home in those price points are the furthest below asking. Another segment of the market that's lagging behind, condominiums. While the average single-family home is selling for 99.2% of ask, condos are fetching 97.9% on average. Meanwhile, condo list prices are 6% lower than in March 2022, even as single-family list prices are up 7.5% since then. Condos have been hit hard by rising costs and associated with ownership, such as HOA dues and homeowners insurance. After the deadly collapse of a condo building in Surfside, Florida, many buildings are shoring up their financial reserves and taking steps to guard against increasing risk, adding to common charge assessments. With all that in mind, real estate is fiercely local, Rees said. And we'll turn now to the sports section. The big headline on this first page of this section, Smith beats Woes, blasts go-ahead home run. Since his return from an elbow injury on June 1st, Diamondbacks Pavin Smith was 2-for-23 going into the Monday, June 15th matchup against the LA Angels. Smith's struggles were enough to wonder how much more time and slack he'd get from the Diamondbacks decision makers about his place on the roster. For one night, however, Smith silenced the critics and showed signs of ending his slump. Smith hit a towering go-ahead solo home run off the foul pole in right field in the bottom of the seventh inning to break a 2-2 tie, and the Diamondbacks defeated the Los Angeles Angels at 4-3, and he, Geraldo Perdomo, Gabriel Moreno, and Lourdes Gurriel Jr. drove in a run each. Smith said this season has been extremely frustrating. He went on the injured list 2 games into this season and missed the next 2 months following left elbow surgery. It's been a crazy year, he said, lots of injuries, and just to be able to contribute finally, it's been a while for sure. To get the news that I had to get surgery and be out for 2 months and lose all my timing, lose everything, a lot of hitting definitely feels, and it's hard to get those feels back. Smith decided in recent days to stop looking at video and go by feeling in the batter's box rather than overanalyzing himself. Smith tried a bunt before hitting a single in the fifth inning. Nobody was over there, so I figured I'd try it, he said. Got to see the ball hit the barrel for the first time in a while, so then I got a couple of hits after that, so it was good. Diamondbacks manager Torey Lovello said he had a feeling Smith would find some success. It was just great to watch him have that moment, Lovello said. Like I always say, Pavin can hit. Gurriel's fourth inning RBI single was his first hit on his first day back with the Diamondbacks following a 3-week stint on the injured list with a strained hamstring. The win was the Diamondbacks' third in their past 4 games. They improved to 37-35. The Diamondbacks added an important insurance run after Smith's homer when Ketel Marte, with a single, and Perdomo, double, delivered back-to-back 2-out hits in the seventh. The rally made a winner of right-hander Ryne Nelson, 3-5, who gave up 2 runs in 7 innings. Nelson allowed 9 hits, walked none, and struck out 5, and got help from some quality defensive plays in the infield from third baseman Nolan Arenado, Marte at second base, and Smith at first. Nelson has allowed 9 home runs in his past 6 starts, including one Monday to Angels veteran Mike Trout, but he has pitched at least 7 innings in 4 of those 6 starts. Working ahead, getting around ground balls, I feel like I've had a ton of double plays lately, Nelson said. Defense has been playing really well behind me, trusting them, getting ahead of guys, letting them, the opponents, put the ball in play. Relievers Jonathan Losiaga and Paul Sewald worked the 8th and 9th innings, respectively, to close out the victory. Losiaga recorded 3 consecutive ground ball outs in the 8th. Sewald allowed a 2-out solo homer to Donovan Walton before striking out Oswald Peraza to end the game. Going to the 9th with the lead and you give that guy the ball, Nelson said of Sewald, you feel pretty good. Just lock it down and get us back into the locker room and turn some music on. Sewald picked up career strikeout number 500 with his first strikeout in the 9th. Though noting that the quality of Ryan Waldschmidt's at-bats had deteriorated in recent weeks, Diamondbacks general manager Mike Hazen sounded more focused on the difficulty of finding him regular at-bats in explaining the club's decision to option Waldschmidt to AAA Reno on Monday, June 15th. Waldschmidt was sent down on the same day outfielder Lourdes Gurriel Jr. was reinstated from the injured list. Gurriel is set to reclaim the bulk of playing time in left field, and Jordan Lawler is already back and expected to get the majority of time in center. Tommy Troy is also in the mix and swinging the bat well. That left Waldschmidt with a narrow path for regular at-bats, Hazen said. I don't see it being productive for those kids to sit up here and never play, he said, adding, I think the at-bats were going to dry up. Over his first couple of weeks in the majors, Waldschmidt was a consistent source of tough at-bats in the Diamondbacks lineup. He was also productive, going 18 for 51, that's a .353, in his first 16 games. His results cratered from there. He went just 11 for 61, that's a .180, with 24 strikeouts over his final 17 games. I think with why we brought him up, I'm not sure we were seeing the same quality in what he was doing at bat to at bat, Hazen said. We felt like he was starting to maybe need a reset. Manager Torey Lovello thought the struggles would be beneficial for Waldschmidt in the end. He held his own, but I think there's more to him than just holding his own, Lovello said. I told him to come back here and have an all-star mentality. He has that capability, but he has to figure out parts of his game. Controlling counts, not going up there trying to do too much damage on pitches that he can't necessarily do damage on, that's just a learning experience for a young hitter. He's going to go back down there and find his way back into this lineup at some point this year. I firmly believe that. And Gurriel is glad to be back with the Diamondbacks. Gurriel said the hardest part about being unable to play for more than 3 weeks with a strained hamstring was watching the team play from afar and not being able to help the Diamondbacks. At first, it was frustrating to have worked hard to come back from my knee injury from last year, then to have something else pop up, Gurriel said in Spanish. I only thought about getting better and getting ready to return. Gurriel said the Diamondbacks talked to him about rehab game at AAA Reno. They asked if he preferred to go there for more at-bats, and Gurriel was okay with it. But the decision was made for him to play games in the Complex League at Salt River Fields before he could return. Gurriel was 5th in the lineup on Monday as the designated hitter. In other injury news, catcher James McCann, right quad, continues to ramp up activities and could begin a rehab assignment in the Arizona Complex League next week, Lovello said. And continuing with Arizona teams, I'll take a look at the Mercury. Mercury hope to regain momentum. It's written by Jenna Ortiz for the Arizona Republic. When the Phoenix Mercury first faced the Las Vegas Aces in the 2026 season opener, it looked like the Mercury were stronger from the 2025 WNBA Finals loss. But the Mercury have encountered several bumps since the blowout win and haven't gone back to that explosive offense and strong defense. The Aces, 10-3, moved on from that loss and are one of the hottest teams in the league, winning 6 straight. As much as things have changed for both teams since the opener, Mercury coach Nate Tibbetts hopes the Mercury can reset in the next meeting against the Aces at home on Wednesday, June 17th. It feels like a long time ago. I think the same for Vegas, Tibbetts said. That was one of the better games we played this year. We want to continue to play better basketball, and that's something we'll talk about on Tuesday. Monday was a lot of focus on us. Consistency has been an issue for the Mercury in June, with the team spending four of the past six games on the road. Practices have been few and far between, which has been reflected in the team's defense. Even with defensive-minded forward Alyssa Thomas in charge, the Mercury hold the WNBA's fifth worst defense and allows at 108.7 points over 100 possessions. The Mercury have surrendered 16.3 points off turnovers and 11.7 second chance points per game. Teams have been comfortable from the three-point line against the Mercury, who will allow a league high of 10.1 three-pointers per game. On June 13th, Kelsey Plum and the Los Angeles Sparks buried 15 makes from deep, including five from Plum. I feel like we sound like a broken record, Thomas said, but we got to continue to grow, and at some point we got to take the leap. With over one quarter of the season completed, the Mercury, who are 4-11, are facing an identity crisis. The Mercury's 15 games are the most played in the WNBA, which means the team's upcoming schedule will allow for more practices and opportunities to salvage the season. Thomas has taken on a lot of responsibility for the team's performance, but the 13-year veteran said the coaching staff is where the players' accountability begins. She added that the coaching staff has been holding them accountable and has done so with film studies in the limited time they have. At their practice on June 15th, the Mercury had to repeat their defensive sets until they got a stop. When they're holding us accountable, it makes my job easier to hold people accountable as well. It works hand in hand, Thomas said. It's got to be a will to want to guard, and at some point, you've got to be frustrated with yourself, with getting scored on time and time again. Just keep instilling confidence in our team and just understanding personalities and how we can make this easier. The Mercury have struggled in close games but forced overtime against the Sparks in the previous game. One thing I believe in this group is that we're going to keep working and trying to figure this out, Tibbetts said. I thought we did some good things the other night against LA, but we didn't close the deal. You can't hang your head too long because we got Vegas on Wednesday night. This was written by Jenna Ortiz. You can reach her at jenna.ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z, at arizonarepublic.com. And turning to golf, Champ Spahn is relying on resilience. J.J. Spahn said he's trying to replicate the same blueprint that delivered him to the U.S. Open title last year. Unfortunately, his daughter is following suit. Spahn spent the early hours of Father's Day 2025 finding a CVS to get medicine for one of his daughters, who had a stomach bug and was vomiting. That was hours before Spahn shot a final round 72 and made a 64-foot birdie putt on number 18 to win his first major. Speaking to reporters Monday at Shinnecock Hills Golf Club, Spahn was asked if he had two healthy kids this week. Forthright as usual, Spahn said his older daughter Emerson had been through the ringer lately. She broke her collarbone at the Truist Championship, so like a month ago at daycare, Spahn said. Then she had a tooth pulled on Wednesday, poor thing. Ironically, Spahn referred to taking your medicine soon after that, but in the figurative sense. Resilience, he said, would be the asset he hopes to carry over from Oakmont to Shinnecock Hills as he eyes a repeat this week. It was nice to get off to a really hot start in the first round, but I think that's the biggest thing at U.S. Opens is being resilient, taking all the punches that are thrown at you, taking your medicine, Spahn said. It's not going to be easy golf. It's not going to be ho-hum, very boring golf. But the way I persevered and was resilient last year, I've been trying to use that since then as well. Spahn has maintained his position as a top 10 golfer in the world rankings with some respectable play this year, including a victory at the Valero Texas Open in April. But he has missed the cut at the first two majors of 2026. Spahn pointed to greens at Aronimink Golf Course, Golf Club, the site of the PGA Championship, excuse me, as his downfall. I think I got a little caught up in the putting portion of Arana Mink, he said. My putting has been very hot and cold this year. That's kind of been the only thing holding me back. I got too caught up in like thinking I was the only one putting poorly, but apparently everyone was, like three putting. I think if I would have just accepted that, I would have done less of three putting, and maybe it would have made a different, been a different week. It was another example of Spahn's mental game being at the center of his result, whether good or bad. Spahn, who's 35, said becoming a major champion has flipped the script from playing with nothing to lose to playing like he had to validate his newfound ranking and achievements. He took inspiration from, where else, his daughter, and the key phrase from one of her favorite Disney movies, Frozen. Yeah, the whole let it go was definitely a mantra that I had kind of all year, Spahn said. I felt like every week at the start of the year, I had to be that guy and needed to show up and play well and kind of validate where I was in the world rankings and what I had achieved this season. So it was the complete opposite of letting it go. I put more pressure on myself, put way more emphasis on outcome instead of just focusing on my process. It was a nice corner I turned at the Players' Championship, where I tried to just forget about trying to be this perfect golfer, and I thought I was last year, when in reality, I was just doing the same things. I was just mentally a little bit more nice to myself, I guess, and not so worried about being perfect, and that's what led to better golf. And continuing with golf, Clark sees redemption after his 2025 meltdown. Wyndham Clark won his first and only major championship at the 2023 U.S. Open, but there's a more recent black mark on his USGA record he'd like to move past. Clark is playing this week's U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills Golf Club 1 year after a brusque end to his stay at Oakmont Country Club near Pittsburgh. Clark missed the cut and was found to have badly damaged a locker in an Oakmont locker room before he left that Friday. The next month, Oakmont announced Clark was banned from the property after discussion between the club's membership and the USGA. Oakmont would consider lifting the ban if Clark met a number of prerequisites, including not only paying for the damages and making a charitable contribution, but also completing anger management or other counseling. Clark promised at the time he would show them who I really am with the apology and the things I'm going to do. A year on, Clark said he still feels remorse for his outburst. That was really a challenging time and something I've deeply regretted and feel awful that I did that, Clark said Monday at a press conference at Shinnecock Hills. But there were so many good lessons in that, really taught me a bunch. I've really come a long way, and I'm excited for this year's Open and open for some redemption and to move forward and enjoy the challenges of Shinnecock and how great this place is and how amazing this championship is. He was not asked further about the incident. Clark beat Northern Ireland star Rory McIlroy by one shot at Los Angeles Country Club to win the 2023 title. He went more than 2 years without a victory, from February 2024 until May 2026, when he shot 30 under par to win the CJ Cup Byron Nelson in the Dallas area. It's amazing, Clark said of his U.S. Open history. Being a major champion is one of the greatest things in golf, and to come back, to feel that and be in that champion's locker room is really neat. And coming back to this great championship is something that always kind of reminds me of that amazing year in 23. And some football news here with the Cardinals. Cards involved? Sorsby to take shot with NFL. This is written by Theo Mackey for the Arizona Republic. There is somehow yet another twist to the Brendan Sorsby saga, and it might put the Arizona Cardinals on the clock. For Sorsby, this twist may just be final, as the Texas Tech quarterback applied to enter NFL supplemental draft, according to multiple reports. The story began last month when Sorsby was ruled permanently ineligible by the NCAA for gambling infractions that included betting on his own team in 2022 while at Indiana. Then, last week, a judge granted Sorsby an injunction, seemingly enabling him to play in the 2026 college football season. But across the sports landscape, the reaction was swift. In the Big 12, Texas Tech's opponents protested the decision, threatening to cancel games against the Red Raiders and investigating avenues for legal action. Meanwhile, the school itself handed down a two-game suspension. The supplemental draft, though, offers an out, enabling players who have lost their collegiate eligibility to immediately enter the NFL. And with a filing date of June 22nd looming, Sorsby took that option. If the NFL accepts his application, the supplemental draft is expected to take place in mid-July. All of this is relevant for the Cardinals because Sorsby is widely viewed as an early to mid-round draft prospect. He has a strong arm and above-average athleticism, but can struggle with his decision-making in the pocket, an area in which he was aiming to improve in 2026. Without that opportunity, analysts believe that he could be worth a second or third round pick in the supplemental draft if teams are comfortable with his off-field issues. To select a player in the supplemental draft, teams submit a blind bid of a draft round. For example, the Cardinals could bid a third round pick on Sorsby. If no team beat that offer, they would then acquire his rights, losing their 2027 third round pick in the process. And with no clear solution at quarterback, in the short term or long term, that could be an appealing opportunity. And we'll take a look at sports in brief before we leave this section. From London, American great Serena Williams will return to Wimbledon after a four-year absence with a wildcard entry for the women's doubles given by the All England Club on Tuesday. The 44-year-old winner of 23 Grand Slam singles titles made a comeback this month at the Queen's Club Championships, playing doubles with Canadian Victoria Mboko. That partnership was cut short prematurely after Mboko suffered a knee injury that ruled her out of Wimbledon. Williams is gearing up for the Grand Slam by playing doubles in Berlin this week, partnering Karolina Mukova. Williams has won seven Wimbledon singles titles and doubles titles along older sister Venus, whom she will partner again with at this year's championships. Her last match at Wimbledon in 2022, when she also needed a wild card and lost to Harmony Tan in the first round. Wild cards are handed to players whose ranking does not allow them automatic entry and are usually reserved for high-profile players returning from injury or those from the home nation. But when Williams announced she was returning to the match court after her decision 4 years ago to evolve away from tennis, it was always likely she would gain a Wimbledon wild card. And Texas' Adrian Rodriguez hits for cycle, drives in seven to bounce Alabama. Adrian Rodriguez hit for the cycle with five hits and seven RBIs to lift Texas to a 14-2 win over Alabama in a College World Series elimination game Monday in Omaha, Nebraska. The sixth-seeded Longhorns jumped ahead early, scoring three in the first off Alabama starter Zane Adams on a trio of doubles. The only late-game drama came courtesy of a scoring change that awarded Rodriguez a triple, overturning an error call made innings earlier. Ethan Mendoza drove in the first run with a double down the left field line before Rodriguez followed with a two-run double to the right. After the seventh-seeded Crimson Tide answered with one in the second, Texas poured it on in the bottom half with four more runs to blow the game open. All of the Longhorns' runs in the inning came with two outs. Anthony Pack Jr. made it 4-1 with an RBI single before Mendoza drove in another to the right. You're listening to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Time now to turn to the opinion section of today's Arizona Republic. The first opinion: underfunding Maricopa community colleges hurts the state. It's written by Matthew Jolly, Pam Duty, and Stacy Smith, guest columnists. As the state budget makes its way through the final stages of adoption, it appears that legislators have once again failed to provide operational funding for the Maricopa County Community College District. Since 2015, the state legislature has been remiss in supporting one of its largest economic drivers, resulting in an actual loss of $656 million. That's 11 years of zero in operational support for Maricopa Community College District, an institution with measurable and profound benefits to the public good. Maricopa Community College has significant capital improvement needs. Campuses need to be modernized, technology needs to be updated, and programs in emerging industries need to be expanded. In recent years, demand for affordable higher education has continued to grow. These challenges are only magnified by the continued absence of state operating aid. MCCD's financial need is best exemplified by its student-to-advisor ratio. Academic advisors support students by helping to chart the most effective pathway through coursework toward earning a degree. Good advising provides students with clarity and saves them time and money. The average student-to-advisor ratio nationally for two-year colleges is 319 to 1. Maricopa Community College District ratio is 775 to 1. The need for more faculty and staff is felt throughout the organization. Advising is just one example. Investing in people, in their salaries and benefits, is one of the highest costs for an educational organization, but it provides the greatest dividends for our students. Funding is not an expense, it's an investment in the state's economy. Maricopa College Community College activities contributed $8.8 billion to the state economy, 2.4% of the gross regional product. For every dollar a student spends on tuition, they see a $5.20 return, a figure that directly impacts our economy as those graduates work, build families, buy homes, and purchase goods. In total, the district's economic impact supports more than 108,000 jobs in Arizona. More importantly, Maricopa Community College District educates students who play a vital role in our communities. Students graduate into careers as nurses, auto mechanics, HVAC technicians, educators, water system operators, social workers, EMTs, and police officers. Many go on to transfer to state universities to pursue advanced degrees. Maricopa Community College offers 49 unique programs not offered anywhere else in Arizona. Over 4,000 students graduated from these unique programs in 2024. These include degrees in mortuary science, construction site management, and heavy equipment maintenance technology. Furthermore, state law requires that our bachelor's degrees must meet a demonstrable state need. Programs like elementary education, nuclear medicine, and public safety administration meet that need. 15% of our students originate outside of Maricopa County. 90% of our graduates stay in state. Our programs serve a statewide need, not just the needs of Maricopa County, as graduates find jobs in these niche but essential functions across Arizona. Because Maricopa Community College admits 100% of its applicants, it serves students from a wide range of backgrounds. Approximately 50% of our students are first generation. Roughly 30% of our students receive federal Pell Grant funding. To be eligible for Pell, a student must demonstrate exceptional financial need. These are not statistics. These are individual stories of determination and resilience. There is a societal benefit, too. Higher levels of education correlate with lower crime rates and greater civic engagement and public health. In 2025, Maricopa Community College District conferred over 20,000 degrees and certificates, the highest total among the state educational institutions. That same year, it served over 110,000 students. All this without the financial support provided to other institutions. All other community college systems in Arizona, with the exception of Pima, receive state support. On average, 17% of the operating budgets of those other colleges come from the state budget. roughly 9% of Arizona State University's operating budget, 12% of Northern Arizona University's, and 13% of the University of Arizona's come from state funds. Maricopa Community College's success depends on the expertise of its faculty and staff. Many of these employees can earn more in the private sector, yet have chosen careers in public education because they believe in our mission. We need to offer compensation commensurate with employees' expertise. Compared to 2010, the current salary for a faculty member placed at the lowest tier on the salary schedule is lagging behind inflation by $2,000. At the same time, the cost of benefits is increasing, taking a larger cut out of take-home pay. Compensation is essential if Maricopa Community Colleges want to attract and retain exceptional talent. The Maricopa Community Colleges support students, contribute to the community, and bolster the economy, all without state operational funding. In May, the governing board approved an increase to the property tax levy. This was a necessary step. The district delayed needed improvements for as long as it could, but it is a stopgap measure that needs a long-term solution. Supporting education that supports our communities and our economies is not a partisan issue. Please connect with your legislators and request their support for Maricopa Community College. Our students and tax base should not be the sole financial investors. The state legislature should reestablish state funding commensurate with the benefits our state gains from this nationally recognized education system. And this was written by Matthew Jolly. He's been teaching at Maricopa Community Colleges for 24 years. He currently serves as president of the Maricopa Community College Faculty Executive Council and the Maricopa Community College Faculty Association. It's also written by Pam Duty, D-U-T-Y. She has been teaching with Maricopa Community College for 22 years. She currently serves as president-elect of the MCCD Faculty Executive Council and the Maricopa Community Colleges Faculty Association. And it was also co-written by Stacy Smith. She's a graduate of Maricopa Community College and has been teaching with them since 2017. She currently serves as past president of the Maricopa Community College District Faculty Executive Council and the Maricopa Community Colleges Faculty Association. The views expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Maricopa Community College District. And the next opinion is from Bill Goodykunz, columnist for the Arizona Republic. White House UFC event was tasteless and super on brand. Nothing says happy birthday, America, like muscle-bound men in boxing trunks beating the snot out of each other in front of the White House. Of course, it actually doesn't say that. What it really says is happy birthday, Donald Trump, which has always been the point of the Ultimate Fighting Championship event held Sunday, June 14th, on the South Lawn of the White House. Sunday was Trump's 80th birthday. Yes, seriously, the actual South Lawn, or as announcer John Anik said, the South Lawn is sacred ground for celebrating holidays, heroes, and champions, and whatever this was. That's Bill Goodykunz adding that. Josh Hoskett's insult of Michelle Obama was outrageous. What it was this. Josh Hoskett, an obnoxious fighter interviewed after his win, being interviewed by Joe Rogan in the Octagon and yelling right there in front of the White House and the president, "Michelle Obama is a man. Am I right, America?" Disgusting, tasteless, tacky, and so perfectly on brand. Hoskett will probably have a cabinet position by the end of the week. You could watch this spectacle only on Paramount Plus. Of course, you may remember Paramount as the company that paid $16 million to settle a frivolous lawsuit Trump filed against 60 Minutes, a CBS show. Paramount owns CBS and wanted the administration's approval for a huge merger, and got it, approved by the Justice Department a few days ago. David Ellison, the chief executive of Paramount Skydance, the combined company, was there Sunday night and was even seen speaking with Trump. And why not? Everything's for sale, aside from an event unrivaled in Yahoo absurdity, unmatched since Andrew Jackson's staff had to put buckets of whiskey on the White House lawn to draw rowdy partiers out of the building during his inaugural party. It was just more commercialization of this administration. The canvas of the Octagon alone had promotion signs for Meta, Mark Zuckerberg was there, Bud Light, Crypto.com, Riyadh Season, and Polymarket, and it was a veritable who's who of MAGA-friendly corporations and brands. Making it all the more surreal was the announcement earlier Sunday that the U.S. and Iran had reached a ceasefire agreement. Trump announced the agreement on his Truth Social platform, whose name was also plastered all over the Octagon. The whole thing was bizarre. The fighters marched through the White House, the Oval Office even, escorted by Medal of Honor winners and first responders. The Eisenhower Executive Office Building served as a locker room for the fighters. Between the early bouts and before the fights began, the event was delayed slightly by bad weather. Paramount showed brief history lessons, often with AI-generated videos. One included a snippet of the civil rights movement. Someone will probably get fired for that. The lowest common denominator continues to sink lower. What's next? A tractor pull? Anik was right about the South Lawn being a sacred ground. At least it was. If this doesn't desecrate it, what can? The biggest surprise was when Trump and his pal, UFC CEO Dana White, he spoke at the last three Republican national conventions, appeared on the balcony of the White House before making their way to the Octagon, and Trump didn't speak, nor did White, though he did appear in a Dodge Ram commercial that aired a few times, in which he boasted about American strength and said, among other things, "In this country, in loud we trust." And that's the problem, isn't it? Loud, arrogant, obnoxious. This is the kind of performative, play-to-the-camera nonsense that can actually be useful to UFC fighters. It's a form of intimidation that, in certain circles, or octagons, it can be effective. Regular life, not so much. In political life, not at all. But Trump and MAGA see themselves in these fighters. That's why the event took place at the White House. It speaks to Trump and his administration, their view of the world and their place in it. Talk trash, belittle your opponent, and hope you don't get smacked down. If you can make some money off the whole thing, all the better, and all the worse for the rest of the country. That was written by Bill Goodykuntz. That's GOODYKOONTZ. For the Arizona Republic. You can reach him at Bill, B-I-L-L, dot Goodykuntz, that's GOODYKOONTZ, at ArizonaRepublic.com. Again, the Arizona Republic is asking its readers to tell them what America's 250th anniversary means to you. Between now and June 21st, we are looking for your thoughts on the significance of this milestone. Answers will be published in the Sunday, June 28th Viewpoints section and online in the days leading up to July the 4th. Select one of these topics and tell us what you think. Here are the topics. What does the 250th anniversary of the nation's founding mean to you? What do you think the next 250 years could look like for this country? What makes you uniquely proud to be an American? And what will Arizona's role in the next 250 years entail? Have thoughts on all four? Feel free to write a separate entry on each topic. Each submission will be reviewed and considered for publication in the Sunday, June 28th Viewpoints section. All letters must be verified prior to publication. We don't publish anonymous letters. Letters to the editor submitted to the Republic may be published or distributed in print, electronic, or other formats. Subject matter should be relevant to readers, provocative, constructive, and timely. Passion is good, and so is humor. Time now to take a look at the horoscopes for today. If you're an Aries born between March 21st and April 19th, Venus aligns with Neptune and struggles with Pluto today, creating a mixed bag in relationships. For Taurus, born April 20th to May 20th, you want a slide of tranquility, but power plays may disrupt that. For Gemini, May 21st to June 21st, social exchanges inspire you today, but prepare for the one person who doesn't pick up what you're putting down. For Cancer, you're in a generous mood today. Be aware of where boundaries are needed. For Leo, aiming for the stars, Venus meets Neptune and Pluto today, ramping up your imagination until someone challenges your vision. For Virgo, feeling more sensitive than usual, you may pick up on the struggles of others when Venus meets Neptune and Pluto. For Libra, interacting with others can feel dreamy and all-encompassing. Balance idealism and expectation while Venus moves between Neptune and Pluto. For Scorpio, getting lost in your creative work? Make sure to come up for air. For Sagittarius, November 22nd to December 21st, explore the ideas and possibilities that arise while Venus meets Neptune and Pluto. For Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th, you may feel open and guarded at the same time, trying to decipher what a healthy exchange looks like. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th, relationship fantasies float through your head. But what happens when you come face to face with the person you're fired up about? And finally, for Pisces, care and connection flow through you today, but will you honor your energy and limits when faced with others' needs? Now we'll turn to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, my husband of 31 years died suddenly 5 years ago. Our family, 4 kids, 6 grandkids, was devastated. We still haven't recovered. We used to be a happy bunch, spending time at the lake, backyard barbecues by the pool, and football games. My husband was an integral part of this. With him gone, we now get together only on major holidays. The siblings no longer call each other, or me, or spend time together. My oldest son quit communicating with us altogether because I recently remarried and he doesn't care for my husband. I'm retired now, and I always thought my retirement would be spent enjoying good times with my kids and grandkids, but that seems to be a fantasy at this point. I honestly think they wish I had been the one to die, and it breaks my heart. How can I bring us back together, or is the loss of my family as I knew it something I must mourn? Signed, Grieving in Missouri. Dear Grieving, of course things changed with the death of your husband, their father. He may have been the core of those barbecues by the pool, the visits to the lake, and the football games. That does not mean that you, the kids, and grandkids cannot have enjoyable times together now and in the future, but you all will have to accept that they're different. I am sorry that your oldest son has chosen to turn his back on you because he can't accept your new husband. You did nothing wrong by going on with your life. If your son can't accept that, then you must accept that that was his choice. If you haven't already done it, start issuing invitations to your children and grandchildren to come and enjoy life with you. It won't be the same, but it could be enriching to all of you. And if that doesn't work out, please enlarge your circle of friends. Warm friendships can fill a lot of empty space, as I know from my own life. And the next letter. Dear Abby, my boyfriend and I recently moved in together, which is great, but he can't seem to hold a job. I'm working 2 jobs right now to make up for rent. I also attend school. I don't know how to tell him that I don't want to be with someone I have to provide for. I do want to be with him, as he's the first guy I've ever actually liked. Is it wrong of me to stay with him even though he doesn't bring enough to the table? He doesn't go to the school or anything. His birthday's coming up, and I'm not sure if I should get him anything since we didn't do anything on my birthday, and I spent the majority of the day alone. Signed, Second Thoughts in California. Dear Second Thoughts, what you should give this guy are his walking papers. You should not be working 2 jobs to feed him and pay the rent because he's jobless, unmotivated, and absent. You may like him, but if you continue with your studies and earn your degree, your chances of meeting someone who will be an equal partner will be better than wasting your time with a deadbeat. And if you'd like to write to Dear Abby, you can at www.dearabby.com. And we've got the comics. In Blondie, There's a workman that's come to the door, and he says to Blondie, who opens the door, "I hope you don't mind. I got here a little early." He's carrying a big bag of tools. She says, "No, not at all." "Are you sure you don't want to wait until my husband gets home?" she says. He says, "Actually, that's why I'm early. I'm hoping to be done before he gets here." In Zitz, Jeremy's talking to somebody who's working on their car, and he says, "I'm going to see if my parents will buy me a new car." "Will they do it?" "Only if I ask the right way," Jeremy says. And the guy working on the car says, "What way is that?" And Jeremy says, "Will you buy me a motorcycle?" And in The Born Loser, the Thornapples are in their kitchen unloading groceries, and the wife pulls out a loaf of bread from a bag and says, "I've been wanting to try a multigrain bread, and I found this loaf with 9 grains. And Thornapple looks at it and says, "Yikes, look at that price. Didn't they have anything in a 4 or 5 grain bread?" And in Beetle Bailey, Miss Buxley stands up and asks the other officer in the office, "Where's the nail polish I had out?" And the other officer says, "The general took it." She marches into his office, and he's in there with her nail polish painting golf balls. She said, "I didn't say you could use my polish to mark your golf balls." And we'll end with Garfield. Garfield is sitting at a table. He looks deep in thought. And the thought bubble above him says, "The more I learn, the more I, forget." And we've reached the end of the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of a program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, under broadcast info and audio.